Welcome to Change My Movie Mind, brought to you by Jay from Filmstrip Podcast.
And Anthony from Tizza Podcast. Each show, Jay and I will debate a movie-related topic and attempt to change the other's mind.
We'll have a guest judge each episode to moderate and ultimately decide who should change their movie mind.
All you have to do to enjoy is subscribe to either show, Tizza Podcast or Filmstrip Podcast, wherever you find podcasts.
Hey, subscribe to both shows while you're at it and get ready to change my movie mind.
Welcome to Filmstrip. These podcasts are spoiler-filled as we discuss the plots, characters, and themes of the films in review. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.
Well, welcome to Filmstrip. I'm Jay.
I'm Lindsay.
I'm Brian.
And I'm Ron.
And we're here to talk about Uncle Buck, starring John Candy, Jean Louisa Kelly, Macaulay Culkin, Gabby Hoffman, Amy Madigan, Laurie Metcalf, Elaine Bromka, and Garrett M. Brown. Written and directed by John Hughes, a huge staple of the 80s, obviously. A big hit as well. This movie was pretty massive. It grossed almost $80 million at the box office when it came out in 1989, and I remember seeing this in theaters and have watched it for years. But Linz, this was kind of your idea of it's time to do some John Candy. And oddly enough, we've never reviewed a film in all the years of Filmstrip that featured John Candy. So what got you to bring Uncle Buck out of the mothballs?
I've watched Uncle Buck since I was a kid, and it is one of Brian's, and I'll let him talk more about that, favorite movie. So we watch it somewhat regularly, at least once, maybe twice a year, especially if we're with family. It's just a fun movie that everybody likes, and it is more entertaining, I think, every time I watch it. So we had actually just watched it recently before I recommended it. So John Candy was on the brain when I suggested a John Candy January or something along those lines. And so when we decided that we were going to do it, we watched it again like 2 weeks after we watched it the time that led me to suggest it. So here we are. Here we are now.
All right, Brian. So this is one of your favorites, man. So what gives? Why Uncle Buck?
It's actually kind of funny. You know, it's one of those things where my kind of a long story, but my family has vacationed at the same place since the 1950s, a bigger lake in upstate New England. And whenever we went up there to visit, we would stay at my aunt and uncle's lake house. And I've got three siblings, and when we would be there, sometimes we would run out of activities that we were doing outside. And one of the VHS tapes that she had was Uncle Buck. And man, me and my siblings loved that movie. We could probably quote the entire thing. It became something that we all just look forward to. There's a couple of scenes in there where my brothers and I, we lose it every time. Namely, the when he blows a smoke bomb right in front of the high school as he's dropping off his niece. So that's kind of the long and short of it. You know, nothing too crazy, but definitely a core memory for me.
We have watched it a lot on vacation, even now, like even in the last few years with all the siblings and cousins around, like as adults, everyone just sitting around and watching it. It's still hilarious.
I just feel like this show has given me such insight into the way both of you grew up. Because, Lindsay, you talked about that you basically used to vacation at the Kellerman's place from Dirty Dancing when you were a kid. And now Brian's got, like, vacation New England memories. At some point we're going to need to do The Village because you guys probably live nearby where that happened.
I love that movie. I'm totally down to do that movie.
It may be the only Shyamalan that you can't completely rip to shreds, but one of these days.
So. It's so good. I would watch it. Don't at me if you hate it, but.
Ron, what about you and your history with Uncle Buck, man?
I don't really have a history with Uncle Buck, the movie. However, for whatever reason, probably because it was on USA, I watched Uncle Buck, the TV series.
Oh, wow.
I watched all the episodes when they were in syndication because they would do an occasional Uncle Buckathon, I guess, in the middle of the afternoon. So, yeah, Kevin Meaney pretending, doing his best bad John Candy impression.
Well, I had forgotten this was a show, and I never watched any of that. Though I did look it up on YouTube, just, you know, in the research for this, and was like, oh, yeah, no.
Yeah. It was not good.
Yeah,
it wasn't even good at the time, but it was like, you know, it was something to watch between cartoons and professional wrestling. So
right, yeah. It was a little, yeah, G.I. Joe, this.
Back when professional wrestling wasn't on 3 hours, 5 nights a week.
Right, yeah. When it was
in prime time, no less.
Yeah, when it was... Just like Star Wars, when it was special. Dang it. When the Von Erichs were mostly still alive. Oh, too soon? Anyway.
No.
So, I mean, look, they made a movie out of it now. I don't feel bad about that. I grew up watching that stuff. So
that's spoilers, Jay, for the Iron Claw movie.
If you go into that and you don't know what you're about to watch, I'm sorry. You didn't pay attention to anything in those trailers because they don't.
Maybe a future episode.
I may have gone to a theater and watched that over the holiday break, and tears may have ensued. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
I think that's understandable.
So I'm also still just as a sidebar, completely amazed that Zac Efron decided I'm going to take the tall, lanky brother and I'm going to turn him into the Incredible Hulk if he was 5'2", because he is massive in that movie, like in a way that doesn't make any sense. Like if you knew the real Kevin Von Erich and if you see him today, you're like, yeah, no, that's not what he looks like. But OK, so anyway, but speaking of larger than life people, I don't think John Candy at this point, like I think most of us know him from his work in the 80s and the late 80s, but he was a comedy superstar of the 70s. And I love that Gene Louisa Kelly, who he absolutely, they go at each other this entire movie. And we'll get into that and how they really work together in this. She talked about how like she was so blown away at how fun he actually was as a person and how nice he was, because she had heard that, but she didn't really know. And she was afraid like, oh, God, he's going to think I'm such a witch, you know, because I'm just going to be awful to him this whole movie. And she said he couldn't have been nicer the whole time, but he was a force. And him, and you pair him with John Hughes, who was a force of the 1980s at this point, and this is post Breakfast Club and Vacations and all these other things, and he kind of had his, you know, right to do what he wanted at this point, and this is the one he wanted to come out and do. I can see why they spent $15 million on this movie, y'all. In 1989, nothing got $15 million. They spent $15 million on a freaking Halloween movie that they knew was going to make money. Like nothing got any money back then for like this. And for it to turn around and make $80 million at the box office, and then goodness knows, I mean, it was in syndication. You talk about the show, Ron. It was on USA or something, TNT, TBS, something all the time throughout the 90s and stuff. But this movie was massive. And like I said, my whole family went and saw this at the theater. And when I'm watching this and I'm sitting there going like, gosh, PG movies have just gone a long way in my lifetime. You see, it was so much now, man, no way in hell. But it reminded me of a simpler time, because by 1989, I was just becoming a teenager. I was maybe a year or two younger than the Tia character in this movie. My brother had already graduated and was gone. And so I was right there on the cusp of sort of like being in that teen realm, you know, where they were beginning to start to protect us. But again, they let us watch like G.I. Joe and wrestling. So they really care what happened to us. We had keys and we just went to the house, whatever we wanted. But I'm just thinking about these two icons of the time and the decade. And what's wild to think about is, you know, John Candy is only around for a few more years after this. It's wild to think about how long he's been gone. And I think about like, what are his iconic roles, you know? And I know he's got a bunch, but I'm not gonna lie, like this one pops in my head pretty quick when somebody says John Candy. I think about him with that long duster, and I mean, he just built a character out of this thing completely. And according to all the stuff I read, like Hughes basically wrote it for him, and then he came in and did his usual John Candy stuff on it.
I could absolutely believe that. You know, he kind of brings a whole character to life You know, just in the roles that he's always played, they've always kind of been a larger than life type of role. And this one was certainly no different. You know, just kind of talking about how nice he was. It's funny. One of the, you know, another iconic part of the movie for me was when he walks in and rips, was it the vice principal, a new one, you know, for giving the kids a hard time and a bad egg. And, I just remember being, you know, young and thinking like, this guy understands, he gets it. You know, this is the uncle that everybody wanted in their corner. And,
and every parent cringed at having
yes, this person in your life. Yeah.
He just seemed like a great uncle.
He did.
He was an uncle for the kids.
This movie does a great job of capturing John Candy's appeal.
Mm-hmm.
I think it literally is, I can't think of a better like John Candy vehicle for him to have other than this movie.
I mean, a lot of times when he's in a movie, it's him and somebody else, or it's usually somebody else and him, right? Like they could have put him next to somebody, or they surround him with a bunch of people. Like there's the one Summer Rentals, what it's called. I'll never forget that movie. And you know, he's always in something like that, or I love him in this movie. It's been remade 1,000 times, the story, but it's one of Richard Pryor's best. It's called Brewster's Millions. I don't know if you guys have seen that or not, but love that movie. I would strongly recommend it because he's great in it, but he's the side character, you know? So giving John Candy the lead in something, was a different twist because we hadn't seen him in that. And especially at this point in his career, I mean, he got a lot of things after this, but I don't know. It was just a neat thing to do because nowadays you don't think Hollywood would trust anybody, you know, that looks like him or acts like him and does stuff like that to do this type of stuff. You know, maybe Farley might've been the last one, you know, that really got that kind of thing. Nowadays, like the comics that get the big lead role and stuff, they don't look like John Candy does, be this big guy and, you know, kind of disheveled and all this stuff. And I was told some of that was, or at least what I read was, that was not all makeup that he just went for. It was like, no, this is kind of how I look every day when I wake up anyway after a bender. So we'll just go with that, which John Hughes is not pleased about. He's like, no, you don't do that into character, Brando. You do that. But,
It's crazy to think, though, that originally it was Danny DeVito that was being cast for this role.
Right. Yeah, I was kicking around in the text chain with Lindsay and Ron that like all the people that were up for this role. I said, Tom Cruise was up for this role. I was like, no, he wasn't. He was 19. He was 20 years old. Even the dumbest thing ever. Like, I can see why people would say that. But that is like the Tribune's going to get better editors. That's all I got to say. But yeah, you know, Danny DeVito, though, in this, like I think I'm thinking of Danny DeVito now and the It's Always Sunny, like,
always
Danny
sunny.
DeVito.
Yeah.
That, like, yeah, I get it. Like, I can get it. It would be a different kind of thing because he's not this imposing figure. He would just be the more weird side of things. But, yeah, I could buy that.
I don't know. I can't see this little meatball of a man running around being Uncle Buck that every American loves putting the boyfriend in. Like, it would have been tough to put the boyfriend in his place had he not been as much of a monster of a man as he was. Or imagine, you know, Danny DeVito drilling through the doorknob and kicking the door in on the boy. Yeah. Like, it would have just looked so much different having little Danny DeVito standing there with the drill.
It would have been much
I'm just much scarier. Danny DeVito as Penguin. Yeah, exactly.
Like, it'd have been the Troll 3 sequel we never got. Yeah. That's what it would have been.
The troll you didn't think you needed.
But maybe the one you deserve that John Hughes never wrote. So, well, I think we need to get into the movie here before we kind of kick around and talk about this thing. So, Lindsay, you're going to do the plot summary this time. Tell everybody what Uncle Buck's about.
All right. Well, we open with a latchkey scene where we see each of the Russell kids, Tia, Miles, and Maisie, coming home from school, and Tia, the oldest, managing her younger siblings' after-school routine. And Tia is a character, y'all, that woke up and chose violence, but like every day.
Yes.
We meet the Russell parents later, Bob and Cindy, during family dinner, Chinese takeout in a well-furnished dining room, where we learn that they recently relocated to Illinois in the Chicago suburbs from Indianapolis, which Tia despises them for. We then take a trip out of the suburbs where we meet Buck, Bob's brother, and his girlfriend Shanice. We get a taste for Buck's personality and his aversion to anything permanent, jobs, marriage, etc., which causes tensions with Shanice, despite him promising that he'll show up to work the next morning for a job that she got him. And then in an early turn of events that sets the whole plot in motion, Cindy and Bob receive a call informing them that Cindy's father had a heart attack. Cindy and Bob begin to make plans to leave without the kids and realize that Buck is really the only available option in the area to watch them. So Uncle Buck arrives in epic fashion and the parents leave, rendering them almost as useless in the film as they are in their children's lives. While Maisie and Miles seem to like Uncle Buck right off the bat, Tia is unimpressed. And while the kids are at school, Buck spends the day wrestling with the washing machine, dealing with an eccentric neighbor, and trying to figure out a homemaker life. When he picks Tia up from school later that day, he discovers her making out with her boyfriend, Bug, who Buck takes an immediate disliking to and does not hesitate to try to intimidate him. So rather than allowing Tia to go out with Bug later that night, Buck takes the whole family to a local bowling alley where he makes plans to bet on an upcoming horse race, hoping to win enough to allow him to at least not have to work for the rest of the year. Now, the following evening, Tia attends an outdoor party in the woods with Bug, and Buck basically tracks them down and interrupts their makeout sesh by boasting about his skills with a hatchet and then grabbing one from his trunk to prove that he can, in fact, use a hatchet. Bug might have cried a little bit. So Buck succeeded in scaring him, and it really only pisses Tia off even more, which leads her to tell Shanice that Buck has been going out with the eccentric next door neighbor, Marcy. Unfortunately, the lie is corroborated when Shanice witnesses Buck dancing, if that's what we want to call it, with Marcy in the living room.
The earliest form of slam dancing I was introduced to. I'm just
gonna say, yeah, slam dancing is certainly one way to put it. So Buck gets drunk that night, drowning his sorrows, and he looks forward to winning at the racetrack the next day. However, when it's time to depart for the track, Tia is nowhere to be found. Maisie and Miles divulge that she has left for a weekend party with Bug, which means that Buck has no one to babysit the tiny kids while he goes to the track. So after agonizing about taking the kids with him, Buck decides that he doesn't feel great about putting the kids in that position and realizes that his concern for Tia actually, and surprisingly to him, far exceeds his need to go to the track. So he calls Shanice, asks her to put her ill feelings for him aside and watch the children while he goes and looks for Tia. Buck combs the neighborhood until he finds the house where the party is taking place. He breaks into an upstairs room with a drill and discovers that Bug is on the bed with not Tia, though. Soon after he's driving the streets, Buck finds Tia walking home, and when she realizes Buck knows what occurred, the two have a heart-to-heart, and Buck reveals that he has Bug in the trunk of his car, and they all have a good laugh together, after which Bug apologizes to Tia. Buck lets him go, but sets down a golf ball and hits Bug on the head as he runs into the woods with a 5-iron drive. Back home, Tia confesses to Shanice that she lied about Buck's flirtation with Marcy. Buck and Shanice make up, and the next morning, Bob and Cindy return home to a repentant Tia and an uncle who departs as a valued member of the family.
Very good, very good. That's a great way to summarize the movie. And for its time, I thought I remembered, and maybe it's because I saw it on television too much, I always remember this movie being longer than it actually is, but it says 99 minutes, but it's a pretty lean, like 94, like it's a slick movie and it wastes no time getting us into stuff. So I want to kind of go around the horn here as we do things here on Filmstrip. We're kind of breaking up the way we usually do reviews and stuff. We're just going to talk about what works best for us about the movie. So Brian, since this is your favorite, you know, movie or one of your favorites, what are some of your favorite things about the whole movie? Favorite scenes, favorite things that go down in Uncle Buck?
Well, I'd have to say the first favorite scenes that I have is definitely using the clapper to turn on his apartment.
Oh, what a throwback. Who remembers the clapper?
I did. I remember that from great. The movie. And as a result of this movie, I bought my brother the clapper about 6 years ago for his Christmas lights in his house, which he still uses to this day. And it's fun messing around with that. So I would definitely start there. I mean, the whole movie is just a series of favorite moments. I love my siblings and I, we love to quote the unbreakable plate moment when he drops it in the living room when he first gets there and, oh, unbreakable. And then, picks it up and it shatters again. Definitely love that one. Being a gearhead, you know, my older brother, especially too, younger brother as well, but we always laugh, like crazy when it comes to the car. The way it kind of bounces down the highway and how it's just an absolute piece.
Yeah, that, the Mercury Marquis is like seen better days.
We've actually joked, you know, if we could find a car, I'd love to drop off my nephew at school a little bit when he's a little bit older in the same exact fashion, you know, really just kind of blow it out there at the parent drop-off line. I think would just be, you don't see that anymore these days, you know, not enough of that. So maybe reintroduce that a little bit. I could go on. So I'm going to start with those for now in case you want to keep going around, but yeah. Good start, I think.
Ron, what about you? Since this one is not one that you necessarily grew up with, but have definitely watched a few times.
Oh yeah. Honestly, what really worked for me best is just the natural charisma of John Candy. Mm-hmm. Like he's always got something going on in his eyes, whether it's, you know, whether he's, you know, in that interaction with Bug or if he's threatening a guy or is yelling at the principal, that you can always tell, like, he might still have the smile on his face, but he has murder in his eyes. And he's got that kind of like really good energy that sells the performance. I think, I mean, it's hard for him not to be the best thing in the movie because the movie literally hangs itself on his shoulders and he carries the whole thing.
That's so true. You're absolutely right. I couldn't have said it better myself. With the, you're right though. I never thought about it. He tells his whole next move is right in the eyes, you know, kind of like like the hips of a dancer, right? Like that's just kind of what it is for Uncle Buck. You know, what's coming before he says it.
But yeah, Brian, I put a dancing scene.
Yeah. I put all of that on all the work he did on Second City and having to do improv comedy. And things like it's selling it, you know, it's almost vaudeville in some ways. And so, I mean, he was Mr. Sell It, you know, and he's such a big guy for you to pay attention to his face. He's got to do a lot with his face, I think. And he does. And I think John Hughes knew that because he knew when to cut him loose and when to reel him in.
So you're drawing a direct line from Uncle Buck to Dr. Tongue.
Yes.
Is that my understanding?
Yes. Would you like some pancakes?
How did I know you were going to reference Dr. Tongue's House of 3D Pancakes or Dr. Tongue's 3D House of Pancakes?
Because the reason I know anything about that 3D House of Pancakes is because it's the same lens they used to make Jaws 3D. And that's we're going to leave that in the archives of Film Strip and talk about it some other day. But that's how I know how that works in depth and perspective with 3D. I'll go next, Liz, before I toss it back to you. I agree with everything that y'all have said so far too. I think to pull it off of John Candy for a minute though, one of the things for me that really works about this is that everybody else in this movie understood the assignment and like got what they were supposed to do. Like, and I'm going to start with Marcy Laurie Metcalf, who at the time was really like Roseanne was kind of all she was known for. This before she started doing a lot of movies and did, you know, some really good dramatic work and is still working today. But I thought when she walked on the scene, like I was like, is that Jackie from Roseanne? Cause we watched that show. Yeah, as she a looks kid.
Totally different. Yeah. It's a full 180 costume. Yeah,
it's hair, not everything. The factory worker, you know, from the suburbs. You know, she's a different thing. And I love her whole, I get the compliments on the hyphen and all that, you know, stuff. And just all her whole delivery and just all of it. Fine, I will go call the FedEx man or whatever it is that she says, you know, when he blows her off finally. I thought She was great. I'm not a Macaulay Culkin fan. I don't blame him for most of his stuff because I realized he was like staged, parented into hell. But he is so hilarious in this, and he's so good. And little Gabby Hoffman is just so cute with those big eyes. Mm-hmm. And I have a niece with big brown eyes like that, and so she'll pull some of that off. Of course, I'm, you know, have no soul, so I'm immune to it. But you know, it doesn't work. But she pulls all that kind of stuff, like everybody in it, and then. To top it off, I mean, Gene Louise and Kelly really, really gets the I'm going to listen to a lot of The Cure and just be the most pissed off teenage girl on the planet routine down. And again, the way she and John Candy go at each other in this movie, only to resolve that end where he picks her up after the party when he realizes she's basically, you know, been ditched because she won't sleep with Bug. And she's just, the way she's crying, like that's a very real cry face. Like her nose is red. She's like, she's been bawling her eyes out. And when she has to tell him, you're right. Everything you said would happen, happened. And it's just like, it guts her to say that. John Hughes movies have this real poignancy to them that I think is what makes them last in a lot of ways. And it's usually when a character breaks down. And that to me just totally works. So I think the supporting cast is another thing that makes this totally work for me. So Linz, what about you?
Yeah, I agree with everything you guys have said. I think they nail the sibling dynamic, especially as I think my youngest brother is 12 years younger than me. So as the oldest, and I also have siblings that are closer to my age, but so the two younger ones are going back and forth the way the two younger ones do. Been there, done that. That is 100% accurate. And they're so good at it. And then Tia being the really bossy, I have to babysit my younger siblings after school because my parents have to go and work all the time. And, you know, they don't care about their family. Like, been there as well. And just like her bossing them around and playing, you know, the mom temp for the kids. And I mean, she's the one that knows their schedule. She's the one that kind of keeps them in line when Uncle Buck first shows up. I think it's so great. And the power dynamic between Uncle Buck and Tia is really real and so entertaining. And I love that you brought up Jay. I think you said that Jean Louisa Kelly wasn't really sure. You know, she goes, oh, he's going to hate me because I'm so mean to him all the time, because it feels real when she does it. She has some demons that she's working through in this movie.
I don't know what she was doing in 1989, but she had seen some shit at that point. Because, man,
you know, I went
out.
Back through and I looked at like the other movies that she's been in, and she's unrecognizable because she is so mean in Uncle Buck. I was like, this cannot be the same actress, but it is. And she did such a great job. I also, you know, Uncle Buck's, when he's in the midst of trying to figure out how to kind of Mr. Mom it up, the day of, I think, Miles's birthday, when he makes those gigantic pancakes, I mean,
yes.
How cool would that be?
The shovel like, under it? Yeah. This is how you do this. But as somebody who talks to himself all the time while I'm doing like tasks, I'm like, I relate to this in a very specific way.
What is he cooking on in that scene?
I want to know too. That cooktop, it's like there's no way cooktop. That mom has ever used that.
No. It's like he put a big piece of sheet metal over top
of
all four
like.
Burners.
Yeah.
Is that on the stove? It just heated it up.
So, yeah.
It's just resourceful, I think. I mean, when they come in and see their house, they have to go like, what happened like, at the end of this? there's no way you got all that back together. But I think it's funny what you mentioned too, Lindsay Bryan. This is the second time we've talked about Jean Louisa Kelly in a review on Filmstrip, because she was Iceman's wife for that one scene in Top Gun Maverick, which I saw her face and I was like, woman looks really familiar. Who'd they get for that? And I looked it up. I was like, oh, wow, it's Tia from Uncle Buck. So, which I'm sure she's done other things, but she's kind of always this for me. This is what I go to when I think about her. But yeah, unrecognizable. So let me ask you this before we kind of go into some other stuff, just in terms of what works and things. Did the... We talked about the relationship dynamics and how they all kind of play together and stuff. Do you feel like they gave the smaller kids enough stuff to do, or was it really supposed to be mostly about the teenager and the adult that is not really a part of her life? Because I felt like the little kids were just there for like cuteness and a little bit of comic relief.
Yeah. I think, and they worked so well as the cuteness and the comic relief.
And maybe I'm just projecting here, but having had to keep my nieces and nephews sometimes when they were much younger, if their parents got away from them for more than like 2 hours, they were losing their minds. Like, no matter how out of their lives they were, where's my mother? Like, it was not, I wanted to see one of those scenes. Maybe John Hughes didn't feel like doing that, but I kind of felt like they never really seemed to miss their own parents, like, at all.
Well, I think they're used to their parents not being there, because we already see Tia taking on most of the parent role as far as keeping their schedules and making sure they're up and dressed and have eaten breakfast and are on their way to school. So I think they're used to Tia kind of being the parental figure.
Yeah. And I think the presence of the kid in the movie kind of served a larger purpose, right? Like, I think they were there to kind of always show the softer side of Buck. Think about when he expresses, is this how she always is in the morning? No, she's just always like this. You know, kind of talking back and forth in the car with, well, that went over well. And they kind of, explain to him where they just the pan to their face, you know, where they're like, oh. or when he puts them in the car and kind of having the going back and forth with that moral dilemma. Do I take them to the track or do I not? Kind of seeing them sitting innocently in the back. The scene where Maisie is saying she needs to have a sleepover with her Uncle Buck and him, you know, trying to do as politely as he can reject her. Only end up with Miles too. I mean, that was a great scene. I think the scene with the mail slot with Miles waiting for Shanice to come. Mm-hmm. I think that one actually inspired a scene in Home Alone from what I remember reading. But I really like his part where Macaulay Culkin is kind of dancing over and doing the dishes, you know, kind of doing everything with a spatula. And, I thought they played a nice role in it. You know, I don't think it was underserved at all. But I do think they were there to kind of draw out and show all the viewers the other side of Buck, because otherwise
not you just kind of mess. Have this,
you know, uncle that doesn't understand kids at all, butting heads with Tia.
I feel like the Maisie school plotline suggests that there was more stuff filmed with the kids that just ended up getting cut out.
Yeah. Where he goes like off on the principal that's talking
about. I feel like you don't set that up without the payoff. And I feel like they left the payoff in, but not the setup.
Yeah. Which, can I tell you, though, that's actually a great scene, though, because I didn't need to see that principal going like, you need to take your academic career more seriously. All I needed was John Candy doing that whole riff about the thing on her face. And then
here's a quarter.
Yeah. And did you? Yeah, absolutely. Which now I blame John Candy for that god awful Travis Tritt song that came out about 10 years after this movie. But anyway, for anybody that remembers that from the 90s country boom, I'm sorry that I just put it back in your ears. But I do love that scene, though, where I think you're right, Brian, is that it shows the softer side of him, but that he can be just as tough in defense of them as he is for Tia. Because what you realize is that he's being tough on Tia, because he's like, you cannot run around with people like me. I know, like, I am enough of a screw up. I cannot let that happen to my brother's kids. And that kind of transitions to the next piece about stuff that doesn't work in the movie. And for me, and I don't think they needed to be more in the movie, but the parents are non-characters in this movie almost completely. Like, they really get like three scenes. It's really the dad who has, like, Bob has nothing to do except make one phone call, and then he's just a boring schlub over to the side. It's really about the mom, and I kind of wanted more of the folk, or at least understand more of why the folks and Tia in particular had really grown apart. Like, they tease the whole bit, like they moved and stuff, but they didn't really get into it much. And I don't know, a movie's pretty fleet. I didn't want it to be 5 hours long, but I would have wanted more of that. So that's one thing for me that didn't really, you know, work in the movie. So I'll toss it out to y'all. Anything in there like that that didn't work for you, or do you have a rebuttal to my thing that doesn't work?
Well, one thing that kind of left me unsettled is how is Buck and his brother so different? You know, what happened in that upbringing where they are just polar opposites of each other and absolutely ended up in totally different situations and shoots. I kind of figure you kind of feel like something had to happen there. And not only did they grow apart with that move, it almost seemed like something that left a bad taste in their mouth had to have happened, right? Like he had to blow up the barbecue at vacation or actually he did. He said the grill was too close to the house. You were right.
He set the bushes on fire, I believe.
Right. Yeah. But that's not enough to really make her hate him that bad, right?
As I mean, much she's folding the wedding pictures over and stuff.
Yeah, right. Like something, there's a whole lot more there.
Or maybe Cindy is just a bitch. Like you can bleep that out if you need to.
No, I'm gonna leave that in there. So.
But I mean, she hasn't really inspired a lot of confidence otherwise, except like maybe she's just trying to do what she thinks is the best thing for her family and take a better job to make them more money, to give them the better life. And maybe Chicago has the better schools. And it just is, I don't know. She's just not super likable.
I mean, they made a huge mistake in terms of pro teams, like football teams. The Colts and the Bears were both kind of crappy at this point, but basketball wise, they really like upgraded with the Bulls going from the Pacers. I'm just going to say that. So if it was for that reason, they made a good call, but otherwise,
because Bob seems to really like his brother Buck and seems to like genuinely want him around. And Cindy seems to be the factor that's kind of keeping that separation between the two.
It would have been fun to see a prequel to this movie.
Like, I wonder why the show wasn't that, you know? Like, Tia is a little kid, like, you know?
Yeah.
They weren't thinking like that back then, but.
Because clearly there's some sort of acrimony between Tia and Buck.
Yeah.
Right.
And I feel like it's got to be more than just, well, my mom doesn't like you, so I don't like you either. I feel like there had to have been some sort of like major thing that happened in the history between those two to create such like a lust for vengeance in Tia's heart.
Well, to that point, Ron, like the fact that her mom doesn't like him and the way Tia acts would make her like him in spite of that. Like you would think, like, oh no, I'm gonna love Uncle. I'm so glad you're here, Uncle Buck. Just piss her off, you know, right? Like, yeah. So that there's something happened. You're right. Like maybe she was near the bushes and like her kite got on fire or something when he lit the barbecue up. we don't know, but it's they don't do a good job of explaining that. And I do kind of miss that. I'm going to say this, and I love Amy Madigan, but I feel like we don't need her character in this movie at all. Like, I don't think we need a relationship for Buck to try to repair and go to. He can have a friend that he called on that, you know, could just pop in for that one scene or whatever. But I didn't need that to make everything else that his character goes through work. But I may be in the minority on that.
I liked her. I don't think you're right. It might not be a very different movie without her. She didn't push the plot forward necessarily. Well, that's not true because she gave Tia an in to exact vengeance on Buck when he pisses her off. She sees an opportunity to kind of get him back through her. So
Which man, that whole interaction on the stairwell between those two is heartbreaking. Man, John really Candy just looks so devastated. And you can even see in Tia's face, she's like, I think I kind of crossed a line here.
Yeah. Oh, sweet, sweet Uncle Buck. John Candy.
Amy Hadigan, Shanice, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought.
See what I mean? She's totally forgettable. I guess Amy Madigan, she's a great actor. Field of Dreams, all that shit. But I mean, shit. Like, you could do the things that she does in this movie and it be, honestly, it could be Bob. It could be maybe, you know, it could be the mom. Like, it could be anybody. It didn't have to be her or some romantic link for Buck. It could be something else that she screws up for him to really like get him in hot water, you know.
It could be something related to the fixed horse race subplot.
Right. They get. Yeah. By the way, the first creepy guy at the bowling alley. Wow. Like, I'm like, Rob Zombie was just a little too young or you would be a star, sir.
With the toothpick.
I thought it was Richard Brake. I'm not going to lie.
The part where he gets the toothpick stuck cracks me up. In Rancor.
Yes.
Every time. He was great. Small bit part, but man, he nailed it.
That repulsive man should have showed up in The Big Lebowski.
Oh, right.
Yes, he should have.
Yeah, he could. He probably was like three lanes down. So, but the other greasy friend too is not. It's not like that guy's like, you know, wholesome and clean. But
yeah, it was a bowling alley. It was league night. That's what it looks like.
It definitely was league night. Yeah.
For sure.
Which means that Buck has some major pull at the bowling alley to get a lane for him and the kids during league night.
Right.
There's so much material here for a prequel. It's not even funny. You
know, with
how Pal kind of pissed him off just being in his presence. But this other guy, Ron or I forget his name.
Roger.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. With the horse track inside information. I mean, there's some quality material here. It's to really run with.
Man, if we did a prequel, who would play young Uncle Buck?
Oh, still man. Uncle Buck, John. Well, I mean, now.
You can't do John Candy now. Yeah.
I don't know. With AI, maybe so. I don't know.
Oh, that's fair.
The monstrosity that would be, but yeah. I don't know who would be a good uncle, the good young Uncle Buck now from modern parlance.
I could have seen, who's a Fred Flintstone guy?
Oh, Mark Addy from, or John Goodman?
Which what one? About like, John Goodman. I could have seen John Goodman.
Or what about like Horatio Sands from SNL?
Yeah.
He can't be around child actors.
Oh, is he one of those monsters too?
He is.
I missed that. I wouldn't have suggested it if I knew.
This makes me mad because I've got to do another movie this month on Filmstrip with a monster, Stephen Collins. So good grief. I might as well just do a Jeffrey Jones movie now. So,
it's
trifecta.
It's Melissa Vimber here on Filmstrip.
That's getting cut. That's definitely getting cut.
The funniest thing I say in the whole episode has to get cut.
We can't, just par for the course. We can't go there.
Allegedly, Melissa Vimber.
That's not making it better. Okay, well, you killed Brian.
He's dead.
Okay.
I can give you something else, Jay.
Go for it.
Other than that.
Go for it.
My question is, what's so wrong about taking children to the racetrack?
Okay, thank you, because they can just hang out at the concession stand.
Is it because I grew up in Louisville and went to the racetrack every 2 weeks during the season, at least, where I went to both the harness track and the thoroughbred track because the harness track was a lot cheaper. So I spent a lot of time around racetracks when I was the age of the Russell children. And I always had a good time. So, I mean, maybe he missed out by not taking. I mean, Miles' glasses are so thick. He's got to be like good at, like, you know, something horse racing related. Like, he might be like the Rain Man of the daily racing form.
You know what, that's a good question, because I boiled it down to he didn't want them to see him do something illegal, because he would obviously had to have, like, there would be like a payoff and and they're gonna ask a billion questions, and then that gets out and around. It's one thing to, like, for his brother to know he makes his living basically gambling on horse races. Another thing for them to know, he does it illegally, which apparently Shanice knows. So maybe it's not that big a deal, but yeah, I don't know. It did seem like weak motivation.
I think the hesitation was more so who we would assume the type of crowd that he would have been with while at the track.
A lot of pals, a lot of Rogers.
Yeah, I mean, we I don't think we were supposed to be impressed with the crowd at the bowling alley.
Yeah.
You know,
a lot of Horatio's.
With Miles and Maisie, it would have been a little bit tough.
A lot of Jeffrey Joneses out there, yeah.
Yeah. I think that was kind of at least that's what I got from it. Yeah. You know, he's going to be in there with that kind of crowd. So I don't think it's anything against the track, you know, because it's a good point. You know, there's nothing wrong.
The plot reason is so he has an excuse to call Shanice again. I mean, that's the, which is again why I'm like, if she wasn't actually in this movie, because she's barely a character as it is, we could do all the things that happen with him and Tia without that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bug guy, I'm going to go back a step just for a second. I love this guy as the douchebag hipster boyfriend of the 80s. And it makes me laugh to no end that this guy grew up to be like a pastor and still is. Like,
really?
Like he gave up acting. He's like a Baptist pastor.
That's funny.
And stuff. And I'm like, you wonder if, like, this is on syndication all the time. If any of the kids go, is that Pastor Bug? Like, you know? So, but I mean, he's such an unrepentant douchebag with his beret and all that. And I'm just laughing because this was pre me in high school, but my brother had friends in high school like this and I knew who they were. And I was like, oh yeah, I recognize those people. It's just so funny.
What's funny is one of his later roles was playing the Human Torch in the terrible Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie.
Oh, yeah. The one that didn't make it out into the world until bootlegging happened. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. The one of the more famous bootlegged VHS tapes you could get your hands on back in the day.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I forgot about that, Ron. Yeah. I mean, well, he almost became the human your tripod because Buck was going to drill him to death with that. What kind of friggin' masonry bit did he throw through that lock, by the way? That would have chewed that lock up in like a second.
It was gigantic. It was long.
That was definitely for humorous effect. But there's also like this whole, maybe I'm about to get a little too deep here, so y'all tell me if I am, but there's this whole sub-meta thing going on there. Like, you're in there drilling my knee, so I'm going to show you what a real drill is. And I don't know. There was some phallic hubris going on in that scene that made me feel really uncomfortable as an adult now. Or maybe I've just watched too many movies.
It got into the Slumber Party Massacre 2 territory.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Ron. Somebody come rescue me on that one. Yeah.
No, you're not wrong. Yeah. Not wrong at all.
Was very much in that vein. Or again, that drill is from a Rob Zombie movie. Probably 31 or, you know, 3 from Hell, one of those later zombies. But yeah.
Richard Brake is definitely using that drill in a Rob Zombie movie.
100%. 100%. But beyond the scene, though, I do love that Buck has, you know, in all of his great virtues, it kind of bothers me that he does take up like kidnapping and assault as part of his thing. But I don't know, Lindsay, you're as the one person who was a teenage girl on the podcast, was this a fantasy to have somebody like beat the crap out of your lousy boyfriend when you're in high school or something?
Yeah, I mean, we don't even have to we don't have to keep it to boyfriend. I mean, I think there were a lot of girls too that I would have loved to see that happen to.
If that happened to my niece, I wouldn't hesitate to do the exact same thing.
No, 100%. And true. I mean, I think it would probably be frowned upon now, but you know, back in the Big Cove City, I think if that happened to someone and the guy ended up in the trunk of a car with a golf ball in his head, I don't think anyone would really mind.
No, I mean,
I feel like that maybe is a glimpse into one of Uncle Buck's other hustles for cash.
Golfing. Yeah, the golf.
Yeah.
No, throwing guys in the trunk of the car.
Oh, yeah, disappearing guys for. I met this man. I'm gonna do a little favor for him
for certain friends. Yeah.
I love when Bug runs off yelling, I'm going to sue you. My daddy's a lawyer. And it's like, yes, make him more unlikable. This is perfect.
Right. He is
they
such...
hit everything just right to make him the least likable person.
Yeah. In he movie. May be the worst. I'm trying to think, did John Hughes create a worst, like, antagonistic boyfriend in his career? And I can't think of one, because even William Zabka wasn't this bad. Of a creation, you know, and all of it. I think back to like Back to School, the character he played in that, Lindsay, like he was such a douchebag, but
yeah, but no, Bug is way worse. Bug is worse.
Bug sucks. Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
I love Candy's. Candy has so many lines with him and stuff. It's like, have you ever heard of ritual killing? Yeah, no, on her face again, you'll be one, you know, all that. I love that. It's just so, it's the kind of thing that it's interesting to see, because you look at this guy and you're like, man, this guy's a total screw up. But when he's thrown in the midst of it, he actually does pretty good, which is the twist and what Candy is trying to, or not Candy, what John Hughes is trying to say here is that, like, you know, you never know when people can come through. Like the biggest scripts in the world sometimes can get their crap together for you when you need them to. So
no, he really nails the character. He does. It's been, I love his scared. His eyes always look like he's about to cry a little bit when Uncle Buck comes around.
Yeah, Bug. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's completely frightened by that. The fact that he's frightened by the backfire on the car is what's amazing. Mm-hmm. And like, you guys, like, not to be flippant, but school shootings weren't a thing yet. So why are you afraid of this? Like, this is not, doesn't check
out. I had that thought too, Jay, but.
I'm sorry.
1989.
Yeah, but
a gunshot is still a gunshot, I guess.
You ever been around a car that's had a loud backfire? I mean, that is loud. That's just like a, you know, just imagine walking in the wood, or imagine walking anywhere and just hearing a gunshot go off that you're not expecting.
But they can't. That's true. It can be louder than a gunshot too.
They can be very loud.
I think the part of it I'm reacting to is that everyone is watching it about to happen. If it just he was just driving by and it happened, it freaked everybody out. Then yeah, I'm there. But they all sit there and go like, something bad's about to happen. Like the car is just teetering and gurgling, and you know it's about to go. And
like the equivalent of like a no windows, you know, scraggly white van pulling up to the
yes,
out there. It's going to get attention.
And they're like, let's see who comes out of this thing.
And he's got the giant 80s CB whip antennas on his car.
Yes. Yes, he does. I do love that the drunk clown shows up and he knocks him out.
Yeah,
that was pretty good. So he has limits, you know, so that's. The fun part of that.
It worked out great because the kids didn't want the clown there anyway.
They didn't either. Clowns are lame. So, yeah. I mean, it was 1989. They wanted friggin' Yoda at that point. Darth Vader and shit. So, it was not clowns or the Transformers. The cartoon version. You know, so, all right. So, if you could rewrite or recast any part of this movie, what would it be? And I'm going to start with Ron on this because he's the resident writer of the group. So, Ron, hit us up.
Vader recast.
Ooh. With the caveat that the only way that I would accept this recast is if, for whatever reason, we're in an alternate universe where John Candy doesn't want to do this movie.
Okay.
I feel like John Goodman as a ne'er-do-well younger brother rather than ne'er-do-well older brother, especially in like 1989, would work great because he's got that nice combination of sweetness, but also like clearly a temper. And I feel like the scenes where he's like menacing Bug would be even more effective because, you know, it's John Goodman and he is just a beast of a man, even compared to like John Candy.
I saw John Goodman in a movie early in his career with Dennis Quaid called Everybody's All American, which is a Lifetime movie about football. You should watch at some point in your life, kids, but he's pretty ferocious in it. And so when he showed up on Roseanne as this big burly dude, I'm like, I buy it. Yeah. John Goodman could play offensive line. Like he looks like he would block you in the next year, you know, cause he's, and then all the times later in his career when he's played some heavy that threw you through a wall, I'm like, yeah, I'm there. I can go there. That's a good one, Ron. I like that.
I just like everybody so much except the mom. Like, yeah. everyone works for me except the mom. And I think, and I know, I really feel like even if Catherine O'Hara came in to play the mom, I realized it would be very much a rewrite or a pre-Home Alone. But John Candy and Catherine O'Hara were already friends, I think, at that point, because they had worked together at Second City.
This is post-Beetlejuice Catherine O'Hara, so this would work. You know?
And I feel like even if it was just the same small bit part, I feel like she would have punched it up just a little bit more.
Yeah.
I feel like by the same token, if you replace one of like if you replace Roger with Eugene Levy.
Yeah.
The 1989 Eugene Levy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's also a potential replacement casting. And I've got another one, too. But I want everyone else to get a chance to say theirs before I add mine.
And go ahead, Brian, if you got one.
I'm kind of struggling here. I've been really trying, but I've just always loved the movie for what it is, to be honest with you. So I have no change to offer here. I'm going to be boring.
Ron, what do you got then?
One of the other things I think you could change, and this might just be because of my fondness for Christmas Vacation, you could swap Laurie Metcalf for Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Ooh.
And have a very interesting change in vibe.
Yeah, but can I tell you, I love Laurie Metcalf in this role so much. It pains me to think about that because she's so good as the weird neighbor. But yeah, you're right. It would be a different vibe because Laurie Metcalf's dolled up and all that stuff. But Julia Louis-Dreyfus is very, very attractive. And particularly at this point, she was very young. So she would look like she did for Christmas Vacation, you know, so the young yuppie neighbor.
I feel like that adds to the kind of slobs versus snobs vibe of Uncle Buck in this town, though.
Yeah.
You know what actually I would have liked to see written in there would have been a phone call home about progress updates, but from the brother to Uncle Buck.
Right.
Because it would have been an interesting dynamic to see.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the mom, after that one call where she's freaking out and like crying or whatever, like that she no longer can manage that.
That you're there.
Yeah.
She does. That was all right. That was a redeeming scene for her, I feel like, because she was pretty funny. She was good. Yeah. She was good in that one. But
I would agree with you, Brian, that it would have given Bob something to do.
Yeah.
Besides the one scene in his bathrobe.
Yeah, it would have been interesting to see. You know, is there a translation? Is he going to tell it like it? Who's going to be the one that levels it to the wife? Is Buck going to tell it and be too honest? Or is the husband going to get all the honest news and be like, everything's going great, hon?
Yeah, that would have been funny. Like, that's actually a good comedy. It's, you know what? That's when you have Eugene Levy play the brother. Because he could have pulled that off and go like, oh God, you did what with the spatula? And oh, you did what's it to his boyfriend? Oh God, you said the principal? Okay, well, thanks, Buck. Yeah, everything's great, hon.
Totally
pull that off. That's a good one. We could totally
have used a scene like that.
Yeah, like it would have been funny if he called and you know, he's talking to his brother and, you know, well, it's not as bad as when Uncle Larry came to visit when we were younger, but
yeah,
you know, not as fun as so-and-so. It's not something to kind of tie it back to the fact that they're related. Would have been nice to see that dynamic a little bit more played out.
Yeah.
You do kind of forget that they're brothers. Like you could, I mean, that's another character that it doesn't need to necessarily exist, except it just does. So,
or just have made her his sister as a character.
Right. Like, that would have even like worked better. Like, cause then the brother-in-law, that'd have been interesting, Brian. Cause then Bob could have been like, no, Buck's actually okay. Like
he's kind of sticking up
for his brother-in-law. That would have been different. And she'd be like, you don't know him. You don't understand.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I like that. That's actually a good rewrite. Yeah. I like that a lot. I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm trying to remember the first time I heard Bust a Move and the Wild Thing from Tone Loc dropped in a movie because they're in like thousands of movies now. But I remember those songs distinctly because of this movie. And there is something so late 1980s about those things that it's a real juxtaposition to like the Perry Como Cordettes shit that's going on too, to have that going and have that loop constantly from the Tone Loc song and the Young MC song going in the background. I mean, it just took me back to a different place. Because having an older brother, I inherited all of his cool music collection when he went off to the military after high school. So I was listening to stuff I probably wasn't supposed to, but I also had like my hands on some really good like hip hop of the late 80s and the 90s before the gangster stuff took over, which I do like, but like all like the Dana Dane and Bell Biv DeVoe and New Edition, all that stuff. Like I had all of that, you know, I have it in vinyl behind me right now. And the Young MC was part of that, all that stuff. And it's so cool to listen to those songs in this cinematic context. So like, as far as like 80s needle drops goes, John Hughes movies are full of them, but I happen to really like these. They're not necessarily as iconic as like Breakfast Club, but it's still pretty good.
Yeah. I really liked the surprising, just the fact that hip hop is acknowledged at all in this movie is a little bit surprising.
In like this super white bread movie, like it's almost office spacious.
In a super like white bread town.
Yes.
I can definitely see these kids telling people they're from Chicago, even though they're from like Naperville or Evanston. They're from like 2 hours away from Chicago and listening to hip hop is to try to, you know, artificially manufacture some street cred because they've heard Tone Loc.
We were in Naperville not too long ago. But we were in Chicago. It was definitely Chicago.
I liked it. It was nice.
It was really nice. Beautiful. It was nice. Me, the, you know, my something like music wise that stuck out to me, Needle Drop, it's not even an actual song. It's part of the score when Uncle Buck is driving the streets looking for Tia and he finds her. Mm-hmm. And that whole score underneath where you've got the sound, the sad, you know, orchestral music playing. And then as Uncle Buck's like ratchet car starts pulling up, it's like a superhero score, like a major motion picture superhero score underneath. And mm-hmm. I really like that. I know, super nerdy, I feel like, stuck out to me more than like the other stuff, but
no, you're just right, though.
Seemed almost out of place, but I really liked the anachronism that they, you know, kind of weaved in there.
Lindsay, I really wrote down to myself who was friends with John Williams and how much did they get pay him to write just that one piece? Like, we just need something triumphant for like 30 seconds, and he probably said, "Oh, here you go." You know, or Jerry Goldsmith or whoever, you know, like it. Yeah, it does kind of come out of nowhere. But because before that, it's like I call it the standard issue 80s cop drama missing persons music.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah. Very gritty crime drama almost happened in the middle. It's almost like Nighthawks was happening again right in the middle of Uncle Buck.
I want to amend my earlier statement about getting Eugene Levy in this as one of the bowling friends. I feel like Joe Flaherty would have been a much sleazier, but more pathetic sleazebag type.
Yeah. You know who was playing sleazebags at this point in his career? George Clooney, because he was playing one on Roseanne. That would have been
true.
To have some early Clooney.
A young Christian Bale.
Ooh. Boy, he would have been almost too young at this point, right?
Yeah. Well,
he would have been a good bug, I think.
Yeah, he would have been a great bug. Yeah.
Would have been good to see Rodney Dangerfield in the bowling alley.
Oh, yeah. just coming by.
This is like a little cameo. That would have been fantastic.
Yes. I'm with you. Yeah. So, or at least like a Thornton Mellon ad or like an Al Chervik construction sign. Just have a little fun in the background, you know?
Something going on.
So, you want to do the ultimate John Hughes drop? Like when Cindy and Bob are talking about who they can call, "Well, we can't call my cousin Clark and Ellen. They're always out of town."
Yeah,
you said that. Like, that would have been funny. Like, remember last Christmas? Oh my God! You
know? They're vacationing in Europe.
Yeah, yeah. I think they Christmas vacation went out.
They won some TV show. I don't know.
Yeah, like that would have been hilarious because they all do live in like the same Shermer universe, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you can call your jerk. You can call your other brother the jerk principal, but you know he's just going to give the kids detention. Paul Gleason could have rolled through and done that. I guess he was doing Die Hard at that point, but yeah, giving John McClane detention at that point. So, all right, so we're doing something a little different this year on Filmstrip because, as a side project, our friend Nate, who did Days of Thunder back in the day, big Star Trek fan, he and I are reviewing the entire cinematic universe of Star Trek. And I thought it might be fun on, you know, Filmstrip Prime or whatever we want to call the main show here, for if there's a line that just really stuck out to you, for each host to just do it in your best Shatner and see what it can do. So since this is my bad idea, I will start with it and then I'll pass it around to everyone, as it were. But I just want to take you to a place. Just imagine you are Shatner, all right? And Shatner is playing Uncle Buck here, all right? And Buck looks longingly into the eyes of his very troubled, you know, niece as her boyfriend is talking to her, and he says, "Fair enough, I like to carry it. You never know when you're gonna need it. A situation may come up, for example, when someone's drinking and driving a loved one home. I might have to get the hatchet out, not to kill, just to maim, a little off the shoulder." Swish, swish. Oh. Here's my Shatner reading of Uncle Buck. Oh, that's
wonderful.
All right, Ron, who you got?
So Uncle Buck is staring across the table at the angry principal lady who has just told him a bunch of terrible insults about his 6-year-old niece. "I don't think I want to know a 6-year-old who isn't a dreamer or a silly heart. And I sure don't want to know one who takes their student career seriously. I don't have a college degree. I don't even have a job. But I know a good kid when I see one. Because they're all good kids until dried out, brain-dead skags like you drag them down and convince them they're no good. You so much as scowl at my niece or any other kid in this school, and I hear about it, and I'm coming looking for you."
That is epic, and I want to see that. All right, Linz.
Okay. Uncle Buck is getting ready to take the kids bowling, and Tia comes down the stairs ready for what we can only assume is a hot date with Bug. And Uncle Buck says, "What'd you blow all that makeup for? We're just going bowling."
I love it.
Nice.
Very good. Very good.
You have a good one.
I got one.
You're giggling. You look like you do.
Yeah, go for it, Brian.
I'm Buck Melanoma, Bully Russell's wart. Not her wart. Not her wart. I'm the wart. She's my tumor. My growth. My pimple. I'm Uncle Wart. Just old Uncle Buck Wart. That's what they call me. Or Melanoma Head. They'll call me that. Melanoma Head's coming. I'm Uncle Maisie's Russell uncle.
Very well done. Very well done. Well, we'll try to keep that up throughout the year. I don't know. We do like a serious movie. This may not work as well, but
it might be better.
You never know. The Shat goes everywhere, as we will
you
learn.
You want me on that wall. You need me.
Oh, we are so doing A Few Good Men now. And
I was about to launch into Glengarry Glenn Ross Shatner as Alec Baldwin.
Hold that one, because I have a good Glenn Ross story for another day on Donahue. But we're at the point of the podcast where it's time to give final thoughts, recommendations, and popcorn ratings. So what are yours for Uncle Buck? Brian, let's start with you.
As good as it comes. Extra large, a lot of butter. Plain and simple, classic and good.
Salt?
No, it's in the butter.
Oh, salted butter.
All right, Lens.
I'll give Uncle Buck an, I will give Uncle Buck, I think I'm torn between a large and an extra large. I think I'm going to go with, I can't remember the last thing I gave an extra large to. I should have been prepared for this question. We do it on every episode and I just wasn't this time, but I'll go with an extra large too. It is a really fun movie, and as we discussed in our rewrite bits, like, there's really very little that I think I would change or I think any of us would change about it. So I'm going to stick with a really good extra large popcorn.
Yeah. Salt? Butter? Pepper?
I just had a really good extra large popcorn. So, yeah, like whatever that means to you.
I just wanted to thank both of you for letting us and the rest of the world in on what dinner is like at your house. I feel like this is a conversation that plays out in real time. Ron, what about you?
It's not that far off.
This is a great movie. This held up much better than I expected. John Candy is just like a straight up tour de force. Like, even the child actors are really good, and that's something really difficult to pull off. And his crappy little apartment made me think of the crappy little apartment from the Blues Brothers, which is also another great Chicago classic. Mm-hmm. Also with John Candy. So I'm going to give this one a large popcorn. Lots of butter, lots of not salt, but that flavored seasoning that they have when you've got the selection of different flavors. But yeah, large popcorn. Bacon.
See, I wasn't prepared. That's a good rating. I wasn't prepared for the salt question because it just always came in the movie theater butter. So it's assumed, I thought. But
Fair.
I'm going to join you, Ron, in that large popcorn because John Candy is so good in this. The supporting cast is so good in it. And like I said before, there's the thing about John Hughes movies that makes them work is that there's a real heart to them that is the grounding piece of all of it. And it's why they're so good. And he just nailed suburban life for white folk in the 80s, like, perfectly. He really did. It is one of those I can say, like, yeah, I relate to a lot of this. And even as I'm older now, though, and this isn't my life, I am definitely not the Uncle Buck and my nieces and nephews' life, but it's fun to watch someone that was really at the top of their game just go completely off, and then again to be surrounded by such good players who played it. And, you know, with all the nitpicks and stuff, you know, the things that could be redone or whatever, it's such a good watch, and it's an easy watch too, like, for all that it's doing. This is a lot of fun. So yeah, large buttered popcorn for me. Hold the salt, but because Ron taught it to me, just a little bit of pepper on top, a little bit of black pepper.
Oh, there we pepper. Go. So, he's got pepper on.
Speaking of Mike Scott, I think Mike Scott talks about that too. A little pepper in there.
I like to put a little crushed red pepper on my popcorn.
Oh yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Oh,
good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little garlic salt, maybe.
Welcome to Film Strip, APT. I've lost the whole joke now. I forgot what the name of the show was, the cooking show. But anyway, whatever. So go ahead, Ron.
We're a gastro podcast that also talks about movies.
Yes.
I was going to say, if you haven't done like hot sauce, just a little sprinkle of hot sauce.
Yeah. Hot sauce is definitely. Yeah, I agree. Uh-huh. You want to balance that and have some real fun. Hot popcorn in a bag, marshmallows, hot popcorn on top, hot sauce, shake, Sonora. And you
marshmallows and hot sauce?
Yeah, just a little contrast in life. It's not a bad
thing. How about a little Nesquik? You ever do that?
I've never done that because Nesquik is like, I don't know, Hershey's powdered chocolate's bastard cousin. It's just weird stuff.
Have you done that?
Yeah. That's quick and because it used to be on the back of their of the container. It was like, also try it on popcorn.
Really?
And John and I were a little fatty, so of course, yeah, you had to try it.
We just learned all kinds of new things, man. So.
I had no idea.
You see, we just show reveals things. All right, Rod, you got anything to plug? Anything you're working on right now?
No, nobody's giving me any money to write anything, which is very sad.
Okay, we cut that segment. So stop my life more depressing than it is. All right, folks, thanks for joining us on this episode of Film Strip. You can follow the show's social media at Film Strip Pod. Please subscribe, tell others about the show as well, and share it wherever you can because we appreciate the support. Like we said, lots of fun things coming up this year on Film Strip. More of these kinds of reviews. Like I said, I'll be doing the Star Trek reviews. And then our friend Anthony from Tis the Podcast and I are launching a sideshow that'll be on both the Tis the Podcast feed and the Film Strip feed called Change My Movie Mind, where he and I will be debating a movie topic. And we've got independent judges from the pod fam out there to talk with us about things. And the first episode of that will come out later this month and is going to be, well, he is going to defend the filmography of Zack Snyder, and I'm going to defend the filmography of Rob Zombie, and we'll decide who's better. But those are the kinds of things that we'll get into. They're, of course, always all available here at filmstrippodcast.com. So for Lindsay and Brian and Ron, I'm Jay. Thank you for listening to Film Strip.
Thank you for listening to Film Strip. You can find more episodes on our website, filmstrippodcast.com. The Film Strip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.